Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
From the Golden Gate to the New York Bay.
What I have access to is a bit different than the public.
Tamper with you.
Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Hamm, Anthony Slater, and Fred Katz.
To be able to bring people together.
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Try all you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, baby, you know, I tamper with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Here's your host, Sam
Amick. Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I am Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic. We got the full crew here this week. Anthony Slater out west, Fred Katz, I think back out east. Mr. Katz, is that the case? You back home?
That is correct. I don't know why.
All right. I've
given you three thumbs up in the last 30 seconds, Sam. I don't think I've ever given a thumbs up previously in my life. So.
Well, I mean, as if there's not enough whiteness on this pod. Just kidding. this is a visual medium. We are on YouTube these days. Make sure you subscribe. You could see Fred Katz's thumbs up. That's the exciting part of the YouTube experience. You can see, you know, my disheveled morning look. All kinds of incentive to get on YouTube. Also, since we are promoting, make sure you're reading our fantastic coverage at The Athletic. You can get a discounted rate on Athletic subscriptions at athletic.com/athleticnbashow. All right, gentlemen, we just had a fun. It's always good to have good spirited podcast discussions off the air before you get to the recording part. So let's try to integrate some of that spirit into the latest tampering pod. We are going to, you know, come hell or high water, go down the awards route this week with tampering, and largely, probably mostly, if it was up to me, and this is where Fred and I kind of having fun pushing and pulling on topics comes into play, is MVP focused. There's a lot to talk about, in my opinion, with this MVP race that is, I think, pretty close, I think pretty interesting, and I think pretty great, to be honest with you, and we'll get into that, and then a handful of other awards. But before we dive into that, I got to check up with my guys here. You guys good? Slater, your team is still trying to get into the playoffs. You doing okay on that front? Fred, your
Talking
team
Warriors?
Is trying to be title contenders? Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Not the Kings.
I don't know
Kings
that they're
are dominating.
Doing good on that front. They have now lost three straight to start the road trip, although they're playing the Houston Rockets on Monday night. They better win that one in Houston. One of the few road arenas they've won in this season, but no, that they've lost 11 straight on the road. So I don't know that they're doing good on that front. They have dropped into seventh and they're tumbling.
For some reason, I thought they were sixth. That was the genesis of the doing good. Good job, Sam. But yeah, Warriors scuffling. And Fred, your Knicks, you know, what do we got? Fifth in the East. This is the beat writer part of the program, but thoughts on your Knicks and their status.
They're playing great basketball. They just missed Jalen Brunson for basically six straight games. He came back for a half of one and then left, you know, hurt halfway into it. And they survived. They went 3-3, and then Brunson comes back and they beat the Denver Nuggets. They're playing great basketball, both ends of the floor. They have great locker room vibes right now. They're good. I said it a couple weeks ago on the pod. I still believe it. They have a chance to win a playoff series. Season ended right now. They'd be playing Cleveland. I think that would be a great series. It'd be a really fun series. So,
for sure.
You know, Knicks fans are feeling good about themselves right now. They're all very happy.
Well, natural segue there, and I'm gonna get us into this MVP discussion. Like you said, your Knicks took care of the Nuggets on the Garden floor. The Nuggets with one back-to-back MVP, Nikola Jokic, leading the way, as always, have suddenly made this MVP race even more interesting because they've been scuffling. They've lost five out of seven games. They did beat Brooklyn after losing to the Knicks. Currently 48-24, first in the West. And you know, why not, Slater? Let's go ahead and throw another tease in here. On the back end, maybe we'll give 90 seconds to our weekly Kings segment since they keep dominating and are now second in the West, still second in the West, tied with Memphis, only four games behind the Nuggets. MVP is obviously an individual award, but we also know there is a absolute collective element to it, which is how do you lift your team? How's your team doing, broadly speaking? And the Nuggets having a hard time, I think, is, you know, for anybody who might have felt pretty good about their Jokic MVP pick, you know, maybe opening that door. You got Joel Embiid and Giannis Antetokounmpo, in my opinion, are your top three. I think there's a pretty clear delineation from there. If you guys disagree, feel free to jump in.
The Jason Tatum crowd. That's factual.
Yeah, but let's start with
Slater. Did you just get up in the middle of a talk from Sam to close all the doors behind you, come back, and then the first thing you said was the doors open?
The door,
weren't doors, this is they metaphorical. Were like window shades. The glare was just getting to me, but
the door's open, yeah. The shades are closed, but that door is open.
That was his way of saying that you know, somebody has closed the door in this argument.
Maybe I was shutting the shades on Nikola Jokic's three-time MVP chances. Maybe that's what I was saying.
So that's how I see it. Let's start with the basics. Where are you guys at on the idea of us just focusing? And I'm talking about who's going to win this thing. Maybe a few hat tips.
What he's asking is, Fred, what do you think about the MVP debate in general?
That's Fred loves asking. It. Fred's so excited. Don't lose listeners because Fred's want to be grumpy this week.
Nah, I'm grumpy. I'm just I don't know. You guys talk about it. You guys talk about the MVP. It's so interesting.
Wow, Fred, you're going to make us carry you like we're one of these three fantastic players. I got to put my Jokic, Embiid, Giannis hat on this week.
Here's my one somewhat original MVP take, and it's somewhat of a hot take, and I don't know what the betting odds are right now. I don't like the betting odds. They're Embiid right now. I imagine Giannis is third. I would, if I were a better, I'd be like, if the odds were enticing, I'd be like, oh, you know what, Giannis could be really interesting. That team is probably going to end up with the best record in the league. The Nuggets have fallen off a little bit lately. Philly's rising, but Milwaukee has just been absolutely on fire. And I think there are still a lot of voters who subscribe to best player on best team. And considering how close it is, and considering how the public discourse has gone, and considering how many times I think voters are probably second and third and fourth guessing themselves, I could just see so many of them saying, you know what, best player on the best team. And by the way, it kind of the best player in the league. I think if you like polled the 100 voters, just who's the best player in the NBA, I think Giannis would probably win that vote. And so like, I feel like there are going to be a lot of voters who are going to be comfortable saying, you know what, best player on the best team. And he is the best player in the league. So just go Giannis. It's like how the third party candidate comes in and just splits the vote amongst the top two guys, you know, like amongst the Republicans and the Democrats, and then it just messes everything. I feel like Giannis is going to do that, but like he's just going to be what Bernie Sanders always wanted. He's going to be Ralph Nader. He's going to be really successful Ralph Nader.
Fred, for a guy who didn't want to talk about this, I got to applaud you. That was good. That was good perspective. Thank you for diving in. Slater, before we get to you, and
not a lot of people out there calling Giannis third really successful Ralph Nader. You're right. Not hearing that.
Right. You're not. That was an original take. Yeah. Absolutely.
He's like a modern day William Jennings Bryant. You know?
Fred has jumped the shark. All right, Slater, before we get to you, I don't want to go too far down the stats road because that is boring for the listeners, but I do think we need a little context. First, the basic stats for all three guys. Jokic, as of this recording on Monday, 24.7 points. 11.9 rebounds, 9.9 assists, obviously very close to averaging a triple-double. Mr. Joel Embiid, 33.5 points, 10.2 boards, 4.2 assists because he is defensively dominant. We got to add in 1.7 blocks, 1.7 steals per game. Mr. Antetokounmpo, Fred's Ralph Nader, 31.3 points, 11.9. I guess, you know, he's not Ralph in that scenario, but you get the point. 31.3 points, 11.9 boards, 5.6 assists, 0.8 blocks, 0.7 steals. You know, Giannis, also former defensive player of the year, defensively dominant. We'll get into this later, but I think the defensive profile distinctions between Giannis and Embiid this season are kind of interesting to unpack. So just a little context there. Mr. Slater, what do you got?
Well, and your little, you know, tidy doc that you have put together, you have put on here the fact that, you know, you said key games remaining. They all play each other.
Right.
With you know, right. They only have, what, 10, 11, 12 games left. It creates an interesting head-to-head scenario for, like, you know, if we're putting it in political terms, because Fred is here, you know, it's like the final debate, right?
Right.
You know, like the,
it's why it's a great podcast topic, Fred.
Yes, exactly. You part of Embiid's case, and I didn't know he had, so he has officially, you guys said, moved up in the, or he's turned into the favorite in Vegas.
That was the other day. I'll confirm it again right now, but yeah, I believe he was the Vegas favorite.
Well, part of that case, more than I've ever heard before, I feel like, when I've heard some people, you know, talking about the MVP, is the head-to-head January 28th game he had against the Nuggets. It was,
sure.
It was, I think it was either Saturday or Sunday. It was on
it
ABC
was Saturday.
Weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He we got Embiid, Jokic, Giannis, rebounds, you know, just so you
five
know.
Assists, two blocks, three steals. And he kind of dominated Jokic in that game if Philly won. It was the signature win. And more than, you know, this is in the NFL where like one singular game typically stands out, right? I mean, that's one of the problems of the NBA regular season. Everything just blends together into this like 82-game mess.
Right.
But I just feel like that was kind of a statement game that has really been pinned as one of Embiid's like arguments right now, is that he just like clearly outplayed Jokic on a, you know, relatively big stage. They have another game coming up. That feels very important.
Well, before you get, let's break that down, because that was part of the incentive to talk about this topic this week. Saturday, I'm maybe assuming afternoon. I didn't look at it. On Saturday, we've got Denver at home against Milwaukee. So we get Jokic versus Giannis. Then 2 days later, on Monday, we get Denver. Man, I should go to Denver. Denver hosting Philly. So you get Jokic versus Embiid again. And then April 2nd, you get Philly at Milwaukee. So you get Joel against Giannis. And I think that is the end of it. Yeah, those three games will I think for sure.
And the NBA has done a terrific job and put them on NBA TV, both games.
Oh, Lord, that needs to get flexed.
Well, you can't just suddenly put an ABC Saturday night game. Let me, or change that out. I mean, maybe right. You could. Let me look. Do they even have an ABC Saturday night game?
No more. No more. Those are done for the year with the NCAA tournament.
Well, there you go, Sam. So it's not going to get the big stage, really.
Well, they're going to happen, and we're going to watch, and that's okay.
And Sam Amick should be there. Maybe he could provide the stage.
Well, it's also Mrs. Amick's birthday that weekend. Probably a bad idea.
Denver's a cool city, family trip.
Within all that, though, you know, let's. Here's to me one of the unique parts of this MVP race and why, Fred, you kind of hit on it before. Voters are, if we're being honest, and I've voted for years, I think you guys have too. Is that the case? What's your voting status in the past?
I'm assuming I'm not a voter this year because I wasn't a voter for All-Star. I was not. I was the three years I was on the Wizards beat, I was a voter, but I haven't been for two.
Okay.
Yeah, I've voted like the past few years, and I voted for All-Star. I don't know. I haven't got the note.
They haven't sent it out yet this year, but it's coming soon. But I think what Fred hit on is very true, that sometimes when certain choices for awards are tough, and when you are trying to analyze, you know, endless tape and stats and conversations with people around the league, you try to have a good blend of perspective. You are admittedly sometimes looking for something that just makes the choice easier, right? So like the Giannis point that you made, Fred, is like, well, when all else fails, best player, best team, you know, especially if he's got monster numbers, which Giannis does. I also think that one of the other, you know, kind of tricks that has helped me in the past, or at least things that would matter to me, is, well, let's look at a little bit of historical context. And sometimes a guy just jumps out at you like, wow, this hasn't happened since, you know, the 60s or the 70s, whatever. And sometimes it's only one candidate who can check that box, if that makes sense. And what to me is unique about this particular crew is good luck deciding, you know, which player's historical context to care more about, because it's all pretty wild. And it does speak to the inflation, if you will, of production in today's game, and offense is booming. But regardless, let me share some of that. Mr. Jokic, as the incumbent, we're going to give him the top billing here. So 24, 11, and 9. Again, that's points, rebounds, assists. has only been done once in the history of the game by Mr. Oscar Robertson, 1961-62 season. You know, he averaged 30, 12, and 11. So I'm talking about the baseline of 24, 11, and 9. That has only been done one other time in the history of basketball. Okay, sounds amazing, right? Maybe he should be the guy. All right, well, hold on a minute. Let's get to Mr. Embiid. Historical context. 33, 10, and 4 as the baselines. And this shout out to stathead.com, which is the place you get this information. 33, 10, and 4 has been done six times before. So that sounds like, you know, not as unique, not as special. But then you get into some of the names and it's like, I'm sorry, anytime you're in the same sentence with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain, who did it twice, Kareem did it once, and then Elgin Baylor did it three times. So Kareem, Wilt, Elgin, now about to be Embiid. So that's his context. Last but not least, Giannis, baselines of 31 points, 11 boards, 5 assists. That has been done three times, Wilt twice, Elgin once. Same logic you apply to the Embiid situation. You know, those are titans of the game, and if you're showing up on Stathead with them, you're doing something right. But it's not the difference maker, right? Like, how does that come into play for you guys, if at all?
You know, stats to me, this, like, it just feels like the steroid era in some ways with these offensive stats and stats in general. That, like, I mean, it's obviously kind of a prerequisite that these guys have to have insane numbers. But and this is not an MVP, take that I'm having. I just mean, you know, I don't know. Like, guys are just like, oh, this guy's got 60 tonight. This guy's got 50. Like, all he... The numbers have just gone insane in a lot of ways.
But we can't just we can't just say numbers are not part of it anymore. I mean, I
would just say this:
you.
All three of them have good enough stats that I don't think it's a statistic that's going to necessarily sway me. Like, oh wow, fair. This guy's point total is a little bit more here. That's why I'm going to him. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I think
yeah,
they all could be like, look at my stat case. I have at least an argument for MVP. And then I think you dive into other stuff. Supporting cast. How good is the team? How generally good do we think the player is? Value, defense, some of the other stuff. To where I don't know about you guys, but I'm not deciding based on, you know, one guy's stat profile compared to the other. I don't think. Because I just think they all have great ones in an era where everybody has great stats, essentially.
Yeah, I'm all for evaluating guys' numbers and all of that, but I'm with you. Like, the historical context, I'm like, it's got a little bit Brady Anderson 50 home runs vibes, you know? Like, oh, Albert Bell hit 350 with 49 homers. That's only been done four times before. And then you look and it's done 900 times in the next 5 years. You know?
But see, Fred, I'm going to jump in real fast. This is why people get pissed off and think that we changed the rules on MVP voting. Because when Russell Westbrook won it, which I did vote for Russ, because he went crazy late in the season. He beat Denver with that half-court shot. And, you know, there was other stuff beyond the stats. But, like, when Russ won it, what was the main foundation of his case?
He averaged a triple-double.
Okay, wait, Slater, let me respond to that.
Yeah.
Of course we changed the rules. When you're presented with new evidence, you don't stubbornly stick to the same thing that you were thinking before. You adjust your opinion based on the new evidence. So of course we change. There are no rules, but of course we change our opinions when new evidence presents ourselves. When we see, okay, everyone is doing this now, we can't use historical precedents as the same sort
Everyone's
of argument.
Averaging a triple-double now?
Well, Sam.
Everyone's putting up crazy numbers now. Right. Is what I'm saying. It's just hard to use historical precedent.
Sam, do you care as much about Jokic's averaging?
There are 45 guys averaging 20 points a game.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, that's not a baseline that is
part
of this.
Even the triple-double one. I mean, you're right, Sam. That was like for a month and a half was like the story of the league, right? Can he do it? Like,
do I care about him? It's not nearly the singular factor
feat.
That it not singular but like close to singular factor.
It was generally like being followed like it was LeBron like passing
for sure. I mean, I would call it an appreciation for the uniqueness of the fact that it's a big man doing it. I mean, that's wild. And this even goes, I mean, now this is way down the line in the conversation, but over the weekend, you know, the Kings are winning games, right? And all of a sudden there's this uptick and should Sabonis get some MVP consideration, like a top five guy really is should he be in the top five? That development within the league of bigs like Jokic and Sabonis running their offenses and being the fulcrum in the kind of way that they are, and then Jokic doing it to an almost triple-double level is wildly impressive to me. Now, there's more to unpack here, too. I voted for Jokic the last 2 years, and it's funny, shameless plug here, I have at least one a week. We have an MVP roundtable with myself, Will Guillory, Tony Jones, and Chris Kirshner on our site later in the week talking about MVP criteria, right? And in that discussion, I admit that, like, yes, like when you vote twice for a guy who wins it back to back and you're faced with the prospect of giving him a third straight one, then you do, that does matter to me. It's not supposed to matter. I don't mind admitting that it does. And so part of what you're hitting on is, you know, like, is him nearly averaging a triple double the game changing decision making factor in this particular race? No, but I'm definitely not swinging it the other way where we're throwing historical context and stats almost completely out the window.
Would you agree with that? I mean, you laid out the stat profile for the three guys that are really up for the award. None of them really separate through stats, I don't think. Like Westbrook's argument that year was like, look at this insane thing
first of
that
all,
I've done.
Maybe we go down this road. I think the two-way player part of this discussion does matter a lot to me. And as great as Jokic was the last, I still feel fine about the choice the last couple of years. This particular year, you know, last year, I mean, let's look at Embiid real quick. It's funny. Folks who think he should have won it last year, one of the things that drove me crazy about Joel's candidacy last year was that, yes, he's a defensively dominant player. But when that's going to be a box that you check and that is going to help you win MVP, I know it's not that this easy, but I would like to see your team be top 10 in defensive rating. And that was not the case. Philly was 12th last year. Denver was 15th. And the idea that these two individual players with such a huge discrepancy in defensive ability between Jokic and Embiid, you know, that their teams collectively were only three spots apart in defensive rating, like I thought it helped Jokic's case. Now, this year, I see that part of it differently. So, no, like the stats and the separations are coming from different areas. And so, I'm trying to grab this number. I mean, the Bucks, let's talk defense. Bucks are third in defensive rating right now. You cannot give all of that to Giannis Antetokounmpo. Brook Lopez is a monster. Drew Holiday is a monster. But regardless, they are third in defensive rating. Philly, like I said, who was 12th last year, is 7th in defensive rating. That's a marked improvement and I think helps Joel's case quite a bit. Denver, meanwhile, is 17th. So now you're talking about the Sixers, to finish that point about last year versus this year. You know, last year, Sixers, Nuggets, three spots apart in defensive rating. This year, 10 spots apart. I think that helps Joel quite a bit. It was a long answer to your question, but those are, to me, are some of the things.
Now we're talking team stats, and obviously records matter. That's a stat, right? Just wins, losses for a team. So I agree. Like, when we were just talking points, rebounds, assists, essentially. But yeah, no, I mean, you're building out a further case. Do you want to talk defense? I mean, what's interesting about Embiid, right? When we talked about Embiid in past years, a lot of times, at least two seasons ago, it was like, well, Ben Simmons is like defensive. Didn't Ben Simmons, was it two seasons ago, he was second behind Gobert in defensive player of the year?
Yeah, yeah. And then last year you had the competing narratives with Embiid and Jokic. So Joel plays most of the year without Ben Simmons and his whole saga. Joker, obviously, no Jamal Murray, no Michael Porter Jr., and then Joel on the back end gets James Harden after that trade. But yeah, I mean, you know, yes, he was down an elite defender for most of last season.
Yeah, and they're third in defense. Embiid has the Sixers third in defense with
James Harden in their starting five. I mean, that's...
And, you know, a lot of Tyrese Maxey, who as good as he is, he's one of those, like, kind of score first, don't really defend that well shooting guards. I mean, you know, Melton off the bench helps. PJ Tucker just kind of helps with environment and shouldering some of the interior load. But, I mean, that's Embiid. That rating is Joel Embiid, right?
Yeah. I think that's fair, and I think you made this point earlier when the Sixers and Nuggets had that Saturday afternoon game. This is what I do love about the discussion and the process of making these decisions is it's stats and numbers versus tape and the eyeball test, the old school scout gut type of thing. Well, you watch that game, and you might have talked yourself into Jokic. He is a capable defender, and the Nuggets have been able for a lot of his tenure to have decent defensive performances as a group. in spite of some of his defensive limitations. But you watch that game on Saturday afternoon and you put all the other noise away and you just see one guy dominate the other. And Embiid, I think in terms of the optics and confirming some of the, you know, the suspicions and things we already knew, you know, I thought that was a big day. And just like these games coming up could be moments as well. But, you know, that is where you kind of have to come to grips with the fact that, like, yeah, when it comes to just stopping your man, you know, it's especially when you're facing a guy like Embiid, Jokic is not that guy.
Fred, the Nuggets have lost, you know, I believe they actually cracked the losing streak, but they are going through their roughest patch of the season. That included the loss you mentioned to the Knicks. What did you see in that game? Because, I mean, you know, Jokic, I believe, had 6 turnovers. Their defense has just team-wide has been an issue during this kind of losing patch. What did you see in that game?
You know, I actually thought they played pretty well against the Knicks. I thought they played
the Knicks are just that dominant.
The Knicks played a really good game, too. They played a really good game, too. I mean, they blitzed Jokic for a good amount of that game, and it worked well. I mean, that's a strategy that can really come back to bite you if Jokic is just going to spray.
Slater has seen this before. Yeah.
Yes, get 15 assists or something, it could really hurt you. But they guarded really well once Jokic passed out of that, and the Nuggets missed some shots. I mean, the concern for me right now is similar to other people, which is, first of all, defensively, they're flawed. They're middle of the pack defensively, which is not a huge problem in the regular season, but come the playoffs, you know, they can be exploited. Their starting line, and the other one is that their starting lineup is really, really, really good and continues to be really, really, really good. Basically, when they have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope out there, they can guard okay, and especially Aaron Gordon, they can guard okay, but their bench lineups get killed. You mean the greatest Jokic MVP argument is similar, in my opinion, is that they're like 27 points per 100 possessions better when he's on the floor, which is obscene. Like, you know, when he won the last 2 years, one major reason why and one of the big arguments for him was how much better the Nuggets were when he was on the floor and how much he carried them. And his on-offs this year just blow the last 2 years out of the water. But, I mean, part of the reason they lose that game is because they're a plus when Jokic is on the floor. And they got really killed by the Knicks bench, which is really good and plays at a really high pace. And that's something that concerns me about them, too. So they're very good. I don't think I think this 5 out of 7 is going to be more of a blip than anything else. Every year we see a really good team just kind of fall off in March and it doesn't really end up mattering that much. And I think that's what will end up happening here, but like they are destructible. Like they could lose to Phoenix. They could lose to Memphis. They could lose to a number of teams in the playoffs, I think.
Fred, that in that Knicks game, which I did watch pretty closely, that, you know, it was wild. The Nuggets had roughly, I think, 32 points about 16 minutes into play, about 4 minutes into the second quarter. And I'm sitting there doing a few things around the house, washing dishes and got the game on in the background, get a little bit distracted, look up, and they got damn near 70 points going into the half. And I sat there, what the hell just happened? Let me, you know, Shout out League Pass. Nice job.
They made 13 out of 14 shots.
Yeah. So I rewound it and just tried to appreciate it from an offensive standpoint. Like, what are we seeing here? And they obviously got just scorching hot from the field. But, man, Jokic and all of them, but Jokic setting the tone. Like, Jokic and his pace during those 8 minutes, I thought was so much fun to watch. Because, you know, we know, again, the optics of what, you know, kind of how he presents physically. He's a big dude. He's gotten a little smaller, but he's still a big fella, and he's not chiseled like so many guys in the league. But he's pushing the pace, fifth gear for those final 8 minutes of that second quarter and making a clear decision to just try to run it down the Knicks' throats. And it's just like lightning quick decision-making. They're either getting something in transition or getting something on the secondary break, but finding shooters, you know, knocking shots down. I mean, it showed how explosive they can be. Obviously hard to play at that pace and that level for the entirety of your game. But, you know, it was a little window, not a little window, a big time window in how dynamic they can be. And then, you know, like you said, then you put a bench unit in there and they fall apart and it goes the other way.
Well, they're unbelievable on the secondary break because you look at most guys and how most teams approach mismatches, which is, all right, let's have somebody set a screen for someone, force the other team to switch, And then you give it to that guy, you give it to that big who's now guarded by a small, or you give it to that small who's now guarded by a big, and he's going to exploit the quickness advantage or the size advantage or whatever it is. And often they try to do it with one-on-one play. And Jokic is amazing at just identifying a mismatch elsewhere and finding a way to take advantage of that. Like, every bit, it's why his passing game is so much more important than the 9.9 assists that he averages. Like, he is, like, it was ridiculous when Kendrick Perkins called him a stat patter. Like, it was absurd. I mean, he is always looking for that sort of right way, and then you get finding it. You, like, learn things about offense when you watch him try to exploit a mismatch that's somewhere else on the floor. And obviously, they cut so well around him and space so well around him. Their issue is not really the starters. The issue is they get killed when Jokic isn't there, and it's concerning.
It is. It is. Before we move on, I want to unpack some Giannis and Bucks and defense stuff. We got to mention, I mean, some voters and fans, I think, hate this part, but it is definitely part of the Jokic profile, and it deserves a hat tip. When you just talk about efficiency, which, again, people hear efficiency and they equate it to, you know, for some reason, to analytics and high-end stats. And I mean, it's not real complicated, folks. Like, it's definitely better to make more shots than you miss and to be efficient with the ones that you actually take. He is having, in no uncertain terms, the most efficient, high-volume, you know, scoring season in league history. This is among players who have averaged at least 20 points, 70.3 true shooting percentage, which takes into account twos and threes and free throws. Up in terms of context of his MVP seasons. So 70.3 this season. Last year was 66.1. His first MVP year was 64.7. So big time spike in efficiency. And he's obviously made a choice to lean into his playmaking. You know, but that part has to get mentioned. As we keep unpacking the different kind of candidacies, I mean, the Giannis thing is interesting, I think, to unpack, because when you see a guy who's a former defensive player of the year, whose team is elite defensively, like I said earlier, third in defensive rating, you know, the quick glance approach to it says, all right, well, that's got to be him. You know, he's got a ton of help on that end, and they are dominant as a group. He's part of that. He's almost that cornerback in football that, and I actually talked to Brooke Lopez about this the other day, like, you know, teams don't want to test Giannis, and so they stay away from him. Well, that's not too great, because you run into a guy named Brooke Lopez. But how do you see the defensive side of the ball when it comes to Giannis's candidacy here?
He's been unbelievable defensively. I think he's been amazing. I think the Bucks are the best defensive team in the league. They have a chance to have three guys on first team all defense with him and Jrue Holiday and Brooke Lopez, who's been amazing, especially protecting the rim this year. With Giannis, he's just so unbelievable in the way that they use him on the weak side. His ability to block shots, but also recover out to shooters. He's so valuable off the ball. And then you look at the rim protection that Milwaukee has, where, like, Brooke Lopez has been probably the best rim protector in the Eastern Conference this year, him or, like, Jared Allen, right? And you look at the advanced numbers, and it's like both Giannis and Brooke Lopez, I believe, are top 10 in the league in, you know, amongst qualifying the 100, 110 qualifying guys in terms of percentage around the rim on layups and dunks that they can test, just not giving up anything at the rim. So it's not just shot blocking. I think Giannis is having the best defensive season of the three, obviously higher than Jokic, and Embiid might have the highest defensive ceiling. I'm willing to buy that, but there are just too many plays, too many quarters that I watch, and I'm like, okay, Embiid wasn't all the way in that one. He wasn't in a defensive stance that whole quarter. You know, he didn't make that extra step to help. And Giannis is just always on defensively. He doesn't really plays defense like a role player almost. And I think he's having the best defensive season of the three of those guys. And it's a good part of his argument. It really is.
Good stuff, guys. And Fred, you kind of just perfectly captured why this stuff is so nuanced and tricky. Like, you basically just said, this is why the tape says one thing and the numbers say another. You know, and there's not a right answer there, but that's good perspective. All right, gentlemen, we'll be back on the other side of the break to keep this conversation going. We'll be right back.
Discover the latest collections from David Yurman, as seen recently, styled on basketball stars like Jaime Jaquez, Jalen Green, D'Angelo Russell, and others. David Yurman is a celebrated American jewelry company inspired by the beauty of art, architecture, and the natural world. The story of David Yurman begins in New York City with David, a sculptor, and his wife Sybil, a painter and ceramicist. When the artists began collaborating, their goal was to simply make beautiful designed objects to wear. Over 40 years later, the Yurmans and their son, Evan, continue to redefine American luxury jewelry with timeless, modern collections for women and men defined by inspiration, innovation, consummate craftsmanship, and Cable, the brand's artistic signature. David Yurman's collections are available on davidyurman.com. Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training just in time for summer and warmer days. I know I'm looking outside right now. Sun's out, birds are chirping. It's time to start getting outside. I know that I like to get outside and play basketball with my kids. And honestly, I need to get into a fitness routine in order to keep up with these guys. And Peloton is there for me. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout, whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class, or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals. Peloton's classes were made to challenge you. There are a variety of classes like boot camps, boxing, full body strength, or marathon training, all created to grow your skills or push you to improve in what you're already excelling in. Peloton's program and instruction push you to be your best. Their expert coaches and nonstop vibes will push you to new levels of strength and endurance, keeping you on your toes while giving you the professional coaching you need. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run indoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get your head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, gents, we are back. Before we jump off the MVP discussion that I enjoyed and appreciated, Fred, thank you for indulging me today. It's very much, very kind of you. We need
I should have sent you a Lakers fine for that. I'm not going to.
We need quick picks before on the MVP front. If you had to pick today, do you have any clarity of who that guy would be, who you think is the MVP? Slater, you first.
Gosh, it really does feel toss-up-y going into the last couple of weeks.
Toss-up-y, that's a good word.
I don't know. I'm feeling Joel Embiid a little bit this fine morning. How about you two?
All right. Slater's following Vegas. Cats, what do you got?
It's not a bad idea to follow Vegas, by the way.
I'm so not confident in my feeling right now, but I think Giannis. I think the defense separates it for me. Even though he's played the fewest minutes.
Do you think he's actually having a better defensive season than Embiid, though? I mean, I know you kind of just made that argument before the break, but like,
Slater, do you believe what you just said?
Yeah, well, I totally believe it. That's why I said
an excellent defensive season.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not demeaning Joel Embiid's defense.
You also mentioned that, you know, you got Drew Holiday locking up perimeter dudes. You got Brooke Lopez swatting everything in the back end. Like, at least defensive responsibilities, defensive value, most valuable. You could argue, particularly on the defensive end, Embiid's value is higher.
And it is so hard to...
You could argue that. And if the Bucks were like sixth in defense with that talent, I would probably subscribe to that more. But they're first.
They're not. They're third. Why do you keep saying they're first?
Why do I keep saying they're first? They're third.
Yeah.
Who's first? Cleveland is first.
Cleveland and Memphis.
And Memphis is second.
I let that slide before. I can't let that slide again.
Yeah. You know, call me out. Why'd you let me slide, bro? Why'd you let me slide?
Because you were on a roll, man. You're on a roll.
Well, they were in first for a long time, right?
So
either way, it's a fair argument, Slater.
It's third versus seventh in defensive rating.
Yeah. It's a totally fair argument. I have nothing bad to say about Joel Embiid. He's having an incredible season.
I don't know who the hell I'm going to vote for. I've been on Giannis. I wrote that a couple weeks ago, and might still be there, but Embiid might also be the guy for me right now. I don't think I am. You know, this is one where I feel like when the league and the basketball gods give us two out of three candidates who are dominant offensively, but also do special things on the other end. you know, that part has got to be part of this game. You know what I mean?
This really is an important moment, Fred. You're hearing a voter, of a very prominent voter.
Oh, y'all are letting, this is like professional therapy.
Just kind
you're
of me swat away the Nikola Jokic MVP train. I think this could tell you a little bit about the way the wind is moving. I mean, it seems to be moving away from Nikola Jokic.
Well, you know, you lose 5 out of 7, things are going to move a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know what? The votes don't go in for like 2.5 weeks.
Right. So, again, these games coming up are going to be fun. All right.
You mentioned Westbrook, Sam. The year that Westbrook won, I always felt like the day that Westbrook won the MVP was in April, which is that game he had in Denver. He went for 50 points, and he broke the single-season triple-double record and hit a game-winner, game-winning 30-footer at the buzzer. And, he beat up the Nuggets so bad that he eliminated them from the playoffs with that shot and then got a standing ovation from the Denver crowd.
Right.
That was how much he beat him up.
That's what does drive me.
I always felt like that was the moment. Like, as much as it's silly to have moments, really shouldn't. It's just the way it works. It does. There are a lot of voters who vote on those moments.
That makes me so sad that you just said that. Why should there not be moments? What are we doing this for? Like, why should there not be moments? It does matter.
Moments memorialized in history, but that's not more important than something that happened in January just because we saw it recently.
Well, sure, that element moment.
It does. I mean, like, time and place does matter, and opponent does matter, and brightness of spotlight does matter. You know, just if you spend the entire year beating up on Houston and Charlotte and, you know, whoever else, and that's when you're at your best, but you fall short when you're looking at the guys who you might, you know, be contending with for these types of awards. I think that matters. All right. We might have lost the non-MVP crowd a long time ago, but let's go ahead and pivot here and get into some of these other awards. Mr. Slater, I'm going to throw it to you because I think we're going to talk Coach of the Year. We're not going to get to all the awards. We're going to do some, have a good, robust discussion. This one, as Fred kind of alluded to off air in the break, another great excuse to talk about Sacramento Kings basketball, which at this point in the season, mid-March, is definitely not something I thought we would be doing when we went into this year. Mike Brown has done a fantastic job and now does feel like he's becoming, you know, beyond a front runner, like a, you know, kind of a way out in front top candidate.
Runaway
for the coach of the year. There you go. Runaway favorite. It's not
with not much
up
time for anybody to crack into the case.
He's so good that he's out here campaigning for everybody else on his team, by the way. He's trying to get Sabonis MVP love, trying to get Foxy some love. You know,
an all NBA hype. He's like, they had him pregame the other day doing an NBA TV video. You know how when, you know, we all have done NBA TV hits where you go into the whatever arena, you go into some little like dungeon area and do you know, the interview behind some banner. So I did one earlier this year. Gosh, why can't I remember what? I was in Philadelphia. I was in like the towel room, and the mascot team was coming in to like discuss their thing. And I'm like, I'm actually on NBA TV right now.
They
had Mike Brown in one of those. I believe it was in DC, like campaigning on NBA TV for Fox and Sabonis to do all NBA. So he's really doing everything. This is more of an argument for him for Coach of the Year. Look, they're on a 4-game East Coast road trip right now. They're 3-0 as of right now. They play tonight in Utah, so people will know if they went 3-1 or 4-0. Either way, it is a very good road trip. And I believe they are, let me look at right now, they're 22-13 on the road. There is the Clippers are the next best in the entire Western Conference at 19-18. They are the one team in the entire conference that actually is translating what they do. You know, everyone talks about their incredible home crowd. Like, they've been almost like equally impressive or more impressive if you consider context on the road. And I think one of the things Mike Brown has done in the last month or so, really since the All-Star break, where they're the best team in the West, is find different ways to win. Herder gets hurt the other day. He's starting Kessler Edwards. He's found a way to like try to fit some wing defense in with Kessler Edwards, who was out of the rotation. They had that win in Brooklyn where I believe the Nets got no fast break points and like no second chance points, something like that.
By the way, just to finish your point, they are tied. Oh shoot, no, they're second. The Celtics have 23 road wins, and the Kings are tied with a handful of other teams for second most road wins in the NBA.
Yeah, that's, you know, the team I cover has 7,
right?
Basically. Right. So I do like the creative ways they're finding to win games. To me, it speaks well to what they can maybe be from a versatility standpoint in the playoffs. It hasn't just been lately like, hey, we're going to outscore you 145, 135 yeah. every single game. So that matters. As far as Coach of the Year goes, he's going to win it. I think that's become pretty clear. Who would you guys say is like, Sam, you may want to continue on some King stuff quick, but like, who's next?
I think Joe Mazzulla is going to get some love. You know, if you go back to the Ime Udoka, but they're still third in the East, and you know, they're only 2.5, you know, back of the Bucks for best record in the NBA. So they're struggling in the context of where they've been. Yes, they're looking at it here. They are 500 in their last 10. But to me, Joe was in that discussion. You know, I'm looking at the list here. I mean, Michael Malone should get some love. I think, you know, they've until recently done what they're supposed to do when you get Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. back. But, you know, Coach of the Year, maybe, tell me if you guys disagree. It might be, you know, more of a narrative dependent award than even the others, I think, at times. And, you know, the Kings narrative, I argued this with a colleague recently who I could not disagree with more about the idea, and I'm gonna put him on blast. It's our guy Sean Cunningham, longtime Sacramento TV man and one of the best voices in that market for a very long time. Sean had the opinion that this year is all that matters with something like Coach of the Year. With Coach of the Year, I don't agree. Like you have to take into account that the Sacramento Kings had gone 16 consecutive seasons without making the playoffs because for coaching purposes and culture and all the things that a coach has to do. That's the culture you came into. That's the environment that you came into. And let me tell you, as somebody who lives here, that the negativity that comes with that was toxic. And it's like a very human thing. Like Mike Brown had to come into that building. And now listen, it had shifted a bit in the past couple of years. They had made some changes where some things got inched in the right direction. So I get that. But the context of the Kings being the Kings for so long, and then not only being on the verge of breaking the playoff drought, but getting home court advantage in the playoffs, like that is wild. And to me is why he's for sure the guy.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Also, a couple, we mentioned guys who could get that. I mean, it's obviously Mike Brown.
Fred, are we going to the OKC segment?
Well, actually, I was going to say Eric Spoelstra, I think is another
okay.
one who has a nice argument. You know, Miami has a negative net rating. They've been amazing in close games, and honestly, kind of similar
they're
logic.
Seventh in the East.
Yeah, yeah, but there just aren't that many candidates, right? And I feel kind of similar logic with
Thibodeau is probably second best, right?
Yeah, man, that's Tibbs all right. Has a chance too. We should have. That's a major omission on my part. I should have been having Tibbs.
Tibbs has a chance too.
And, we talked about Tibbs like a month ago,
Mark. Since you said it, Mark Daigneault in OKC. I mean, you know they. You talked about how it's a narrative award. The award always seems to go to the coach of the team that defied expectations the most. And in this case, that is Mike Brown. But Mike Brown has also done an unbelievable job this year. There's no debating against that. OKC is maybe defied expectations the second most. So I bet you he's going to show up.
I feel
up
like
on
your Knicks
ballots.
Have, though. No?
Knicks definitely have. I mean, I think Tibbs is going to be on ballots too, for sure. I agree.
Yeah, I think Tibbs, like I said, we talked about it like a month ago. I thought he was the guy. I think Tibbs will get votes, and he should.
Isn't it amazing how, with Tibbs, how everybody is either collectively totally out on him or is throwing him on Coach of the Year ballots, and there doesn't ever seem to be an in-between?
This year, people are totally out?
Yeah, sure. They started 10-13, and
oh, yeah, we thought he was in trouble.
Is Tibbs going to be out? Now they've totally turned it around. They've been one of the best teams in the league since early December. They are playing well on both sides of the ball. They're beating good teams. They're objectively well coached. Like everyone on that team plays a great role and stays within their role. And they have a really analytically friendly shot profile and they play crazy hard. They just play harder than every other team. And earlier this year, people had him out. Last year, people had him out. Over the summer, people had him out.
And it's his year
before
third
that,
year,
he won
Fred.
Coach of the Year. Yeah,
I know, but this is what I love about Yeah, I think I'm going Brown, Tibbs, 1-2 for sure, unless something drastically changes. But this is his third year, and that's what I love about this. This is like, you know, hosting a party and that one guest that you don't really enjoy who always, you know, tells the worst stories and you wish they would leave. Like, out of nowhere, that dude just starts dropping just great punchlines and you're loving life. Like, Tibbs in his third year inspiring his team is not something we've seen for a while. In Minnesota, he wore out his welcome. In Chicago, it was a little longer than that, but he wore out his welcome. And I give him credit. I don't know how he's done it, but he's got that group playing at this level. And that is, you talk about narratives, that runs counter to the Tom Thibodeau narrative.
Well, I'll tell you one way that he's done it is the organization has made a very conscious decision to acquire Tibbs-like players. Tibbs appropriate players.
The Jimmy Butlers of the world.
The Jimmy Butlers of the world. Quentin Grimes is a Tibbs player. He is in the practice facility all the time and he works like crazy and he's tough. Emmanuel Quickley is a Tibbs player. They trade for Josh Hart. He's a Tibbs player. Jalen Brunson signed with the Knicks in part because he wanted to play for Tibbs, because his dad played for Tibbs when Tibbs was an assistant coach with the Knicks in the 90s, and he's known Tibbs since he was like 5 years old, and he wanted to play for Tibbs. Meanwhile, when Brunson gets hurt in a game against Miami a couple of weeks ago, he rolls his ankle so badly that he's on the ground when he's playing defense. The Knicks go back, play offense 4-on-5. Miami gets a takeaway. Jimmy Butler, I believe it was, comes flying back down the other way on a fast break, and Brunson is still on the floor under the basket. He hobbles up. He hobbles up after rolling his ankle, can't really walk, had to leave the game after this, and just kind of limps all gimpy outside of the restricted area and tries to take a charge on the fast break. And it's like, these dudes just play this Tibbsy sort of way naturally. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure there are moments with guys on that team where they feel like it's a little bit too much. And that was the case, obviously, with like Cam Reddish, who's no longer there. But a lot of these guys are just like, this is in the personality of how they play, you know?
Can I ask you something, though? So he won Coach of the Year a couple of years ago, right? 2 years ago? Over Monty Williams when the Suns ended up going to the finals. And then they lost in the first round. And what if they lose in the first round this year? Does the Heat get turned back up? Is he in any danger? Because, you know, some of the historical reputation of Tom Thibodeau is maximize what you can be in the regular season. And you kind of maybe flame out in the playoffs because, you know, part of it is because other teams start scouting and caring as much as your team does on a nightly basis. What happens if they disappoint? Like how big are the stakes in round one, I should say?
I think it probably depends on how it happens. If they go the first round and they play Cleveland and they get totally overwhelmed and they get swept and they look horrible, then I'm not going to say that's not possible. That obviously is possible. If they play a really hard fought series against Cleveland and they just kind of lose to the better team, then I would say probably not. I get the sense that the organization is pretty encouraged by what's going on with this group. And remember, they're good. They're 42-30. Heading into tonight's game against Minnesota. They are good, but they're not just good. They're in a good spot for the future, right? Like they've got all of their own draft picks. They've got 4 draft picks from other teams. They've got mid-sized contracts. Like, you know, they're in a position to trade for a star. And I was critical of their strategy early in the year for wanting to trade for the first star in the door. But the thing is, at the time they were 2 stars away, and we didn't realize on the outside, Jalen Brunson was kind of going to be that guy. And Julius Randle was going to recover his caliber of play in a more sustainable way from when he made All-NBA a couple of years ago. And he's doing it with a revised shot profile and really playing totally different stylistically, more off the ball with Jalen Brunson there. And it does feel like when you watch them, like, okay, they are a star away. So, anything can happen depending on how that loss would go in the first round if it were to happen. But I would say they have good vibes in that organization right now. I think from the locker room up to the front office, they're pretty encouraged by what's going on.
Before we pivot to the last one, we're going to do most improved player in a moment and let Slater lead that conversation. Isn't it funny? Again, this is why the fans, I think, we do drive them crazy with how the rules are kind of different on different awards. And I think you guys will agree, you know, Coach of the Year and Slater, the way you kind of framed the Thibodeau discussion, kind of what struck me about that is that, you know, when voters, media members go to decide who the Coach of the Year is, you don't hear a lot about how, well, I'm not as comfortable voting for Tibbs because he hasn't proven himself in the playoffs enough. You know what I mean? Like the ideas that are sometimes assigned to things like MVP, where certain, I mean, I get it. Certain awards come with, they just mean more. And MVP means more than anything. And so with Coach of the Year, though, you can rest easy at night. I don't really care if Tibbs ever advances in the playoffs. Like, I think, you know, he deserves some votes this year. It's just, it, reality of it is certain awards are viewed differently.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it helps to win Coach of the Year, but at the end of the day, like, the playoffs will define, you know, Thibodeau was facing a lot of coaches heat of the by year the end of that fired. Season that he won, right? You know, like Mike Brown won it in Cleveland. Scotty Brooks won it in Oklahoma City.
And yeah, Mike won it in Cleveland and then was out after the following season.
George Karl won it and got fired. Dwayne Casey won it and got fired right away.
And in conclusion, the front office executives and owners do not care what we think. I think that's pretty evident. All right, let's talk most improved player as we wrap up here. We had Slater and Katz both pick a non-MVP award that they was of most interest to them. Slater, what are you thinking on MIP?
Well, it seems to be, you know, and this is the award, as Fred has talked about plenty, that it's just like the field is always much wider. But I don't know. I feel like this year it's pretty condensed. I mean, Lauri Markkanen, I think, is the favorite, probably, at least in my opinion. I'd probably pick him. Brunson is a candidate. You know, he's been given the bigger role, and as Fred just mentioned, he's kind of elevated into a level of to a tier that nobody thought he could reach. Tyrese Halliburton is probably considered the more traditional candidate, right? He makes the young career leap into all-star status. So I don't have any grand deep dives into it, but I like Markkanen's case more than anybody else. He was a throw-in in the Donovan Mitchell trade that seemed to be like, hey, they might just bounce him to another team, and pretty quickly became their franchise player. Like, he's probably going to get maxed out. He was untouchable at the deadline, according to basically all accounts. And I think he's the unlikeliest of these stories, and I think he'd be my most improved player.
No, I like that. I you know, the Halliburton one, his injury stuff, we'll see if that impacts voting. He's only played 54 games. I like the idea that it's not a second or third year guy this time around. You know, Lowry's in his fifth year. I just had that in front of me. Brunson, maybe I have it backwards. What year is Brunson, Fred?
Brunson's in his fifth year.
Yeah, Brunson's fifth. Lowry is sixth. And you see major, major jumps. Now, with Lowry, obviously scenery change going from Cleveland to Utah. The Brunson one, I mean, I don't know who I would vote for at this point. You know, maybe Lowry by a hair. But Brunson's is, I mean, the narrative is pretty great, too. You leave Dallas where they didn't think you were, you know, worth paying this kind of money to put next to Luka because they needed somebody apparently, you know, more special. Or at least, you know, that was the vibe when they were trying to potentially do an extension that where they could have gotten in for a much lower number. And you talk about that coming back to bite you in his fifth year. You know, he jumps from 18.3 points last season to 23.8, and still efficient along the way. Pretty big uptick in his three-point shooting percentage-wise and volume-wise. You know, those two guys, I think, are probably my choice. Top two. Maybe Halliburton from there.
I think I would probably vote for him. But I'm a little conflicted because how do we feel about a guy who was improved but not improved enough to be like on the leaderboard for MIP, then changed teams, and then is doing since changing teams, playing at a level that would definitely win him MIP if he did it over the course of a season? Because that's what's happened with Mikal Bridges. And I don't know how to evaluate him in the context of MIP voting because Mikal Bridges was, first of all, it's hard to tell how much of it is exactly. It's most improved. It's hard to tell a little bit how much of Bridges' production with Brooklyn has to do with opportunity versus actual improvement. Because in Phoenix,
Is that hard to tell though? I don't think it is because it's literally one day to the next.
Yeah.
Went to this. To the Nets, and
no,
like,
for sure.
Then he didn't
for sure.
When like I work on his game,
I mean from
trade,
last year to like this year, because ultimately we're not we're doing how much he improved from last year, and it's hard to tell if this improvement came over the summer or if this improvement was before and it was how he was being used. Like it's just kind of difficult, and there's a little bit of that element in Jalen Brunson's argument as well, right? Because you look at the numbers of Brunson had when Luka was off the floor in Dallas, and he was averaging like 22 points per 36 minutes on really good efficiency, and you see how Brunson played when Luka got hurt in the playoffs, and Brunson was, you know, roasting Utah and had a really good series against Phoenix after that. So like there's a little bit of that element too, even with Halliburton as well, where after the trade last year, Halliburton played great for the Pacers. And then he ticked it up a little bit this year, but we saw that leap when he went to Indiana in the middle of last season. So I don't know. I mean, Mikal Bridges in 16 games with Brooklyn, 26 points a game, 50 from the field, 44 from three. He's got a 57% effective field goal percentage, which is excellent on that sort of usage. It's just, I'm not arguing it should be him. I think I would probably vote for Markkanen. I'm just saying he's kind of a unique MIP case.
I'm just disappointed. He's very unique. This is worth spotlighting, highlighting. But Fred, did you not come into this week's podcast saying that you were the one who wanted to just give a little love to the OKC Thunder? And we've gotten way too deep into this conversation without talking about young Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who, before you respond, is, for all intents and purposes, like the Ja Morant pick of this year. Because last year when Ja won it, there was some spirited debate about how was he already too good to be in the running. LeBron even tweeted about it, that, you know, that Ja should not be in that race because he's a star. But I mean, it's still, when you're talking about year number five, Shai goes from 24.5 points to 31.4. I voted for Ja, and I just see that jump differently. Like there's no, that jump is not guaranteed. You know, nobody last year was saying, oh, it'll be fun to watch Shai go from, you know, from a high level all-star caliber scorer to an MVP caliber scorer.
He is.
From 1 year to the next.
He's an amazing player.
You know, Shai is in this conversation for sure, I think.
I it's a good point. Yeah. I mean, before the season, I would have said the Thunder are still searching for their, you know, 1A for the next era, right? Could it be Chet? You know, is it a future draft pick? You know, like Shai is a great piece, but he's not, you know, your pillar for a contender.
Right.
Now he
isn't
is,
Shai, right? Isn't Shai, you know, the 1B to Jalen Williams?
Large, large leap.
No doubt.
Jalen Williams, number.
Now, see, Sam is trying to get us into a rookie of the year conversation.
That we don't need to have. Ben Mathurin to number two in rookie of the year. Oklahoma City Thunder, fifth in net rating since January 1st.
It's a good take.
2.5 months. That team's dangerous.
He's coming with stats today, Sam. Get us out of here before he dies.
I'm going to tie bows. You missed your shot at the OKC segment. You just let it fly right by. You're talking about Mikal Bridges. Mikal Bridges was good for 5 minutes.
The Bridges
Let's give
thing
him the MIP
is,
award.
I can't remember the last time we saw something.
I'm
going to
tie a
like
bow on it. No, this is why I love the pod. It's good to give it some shine. And
this is the New York
classic New York media.
Elbridge has never played a game before he showed up in Brooklyn.
When half of the papers don't have Nets beat writers.
That's right. All right, let me tie a bow on it like this to go full circle with an MVP tie-in. I had a delightful couple of conversations last week with Thanasis Antetokounmpo while I was around the Bucks, and we were talking about Giannis, and I was admittedly at one point bringing up the MVP conversation and kind of getting perspective on his brother and his state of mind these days. What I thought was great, it'll never happen, but I thought was great, was he shared a conversation about how he and his brother, they'll talk about what's next for Giannis and what he should be gunning for. And he wasn't really trying to be funny. Again, I don't think this will happen, but apparently they've talked extensively about how the ultimate kind of award honor that he would love to get at some point in his career is to already be a two-time, maybe about to be three-time MVP, a one-time champion, could be a two-time champion this season, but to win the most improved player award at this status that he's decided like that he wants to find a way to be the most improved player. So I don't see it happening, but you know, shout out to players trying to be greater and trying to push. I thought that was kind of a cool little anecdote.
A heartwarming end to another podcast. Sam Amick, take us out.
That's it, gentlemen. I appreciate you. Thank you, as always, to the listeners. We did not get to all the awards, but we got to a lot, and Fred survived. You okay, Fred? That was a long MVP discussion. You all right, buddy? Grumpy, edgy New York media for you. All right. Thanks, everybody. See you.